Welcome to the Wyeth Foundation for American Art Lecture. In this lecture, presented on November 6, 2019, Kelly Jones of Columbia University looks at international conceptual art networks and the making of global community in the late 20th century. The lecture considers moments in the global reach of performance art in the 1970s, in locale from Mexico City to London to Los Angeles, considering projects by artists including Felipe Ehrenberg, Lourdes Grobet, Adrian Piper, Senga Nengudi, and David Lamelas. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this afternoon's Wyeth Lecture in American Art. This is, in fact, the 9th Wyeth Lecture at the National Gallery, a biennial event established at CASVA in 2003 and supported by the Wyeth Foundation for American Art. We're all immensely grateful to the Wyeth Foundation for their vision in supporting this series as part of a larger program for the encouragement of the study of American art at the Center and at the National Gallery. As many of you already know, in alternating years, CASVA presents, instead of a distinguished lecture, a conference involving emerging colleagues in the field around a topic of interest. And I'm happy to say we're already planning for the conference in 2020, when museums around the mall, including this one, will be celebrating the 19th Amendment. A longer term and key aspect of support for scholarship in American art at CASVA has been the 2-year Wyeth Predoctoral Fellowship, which has benefited so many graduate students across the country as they begin their careers. And tonight, we're fortunate to have as our lecturer a scholar who has inspired so many of those emerging scholars, as well as setting a very high standard for research and curatorial practice across the country and internationally. Kelly Jones, I've learned, is a proud alumna of Amherst College and an advocate for a liberal arts education. After receiving her PhD from Yale, she established her teaching and research career at Yale, broadening and deepening the curriculum there with courses on Latin American artists, African American artists, Black British art, and early African American visual and decorative arts. Since 2006, she's been a member of the department at Columbia University, where she's also undertaken extraordinary service on behalf of the department, including directing the MA in Modern Art, Critical and Curatorial Studies. And who better to do this than Kelly Jones, who brings to her work as a professor 7 years of experience at the Walker Arts Center, 4 years at the Jamaica Arts Center in New York, and extended periods at the Broider Museum and the Studio Museum in Harlem. I simply cannot summarize the list of Kelly Jones' publications and exhibitions, all of which have had such an impact on the field and on public understanding of the arts. From South of Pico, African American artists in Los Angeles in the 1960s and 70s, to Now Dig This, Art in Black Los Angeles, 1960 to 1980, and monographic treatments of Dawood Bey, Martin Perrier, Lorna Simpson, David Hammond, Kelly Jones's publications, whether connected to exhibitions or not, have always put the art in the foreground, and they've always recognized the importance of the archive and of deep grounding in context and in history. And we're delighted that she's a contributor to our forthcoming Black Modernism seminar volume, edited by Stephen Nelson and Huey Copeland. For her dedication to the history of art and of cultural understanding, Professor Jones has been recognized with the MacArthur Fellowship, the David Driscoll Prize in African American Art History at the High Museum, and the James A. Porter Book Award at Howard University. A member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Professor Jones will be honored at the 2020 College Art Association with the Association's Distinguished Scholar Award. In a recent interview, Kelly Jones expressed her continuing enthusiasm for art history, a discipline that encourages all the qualities of the diplomat she once considered becoming, as she put it, learning languages, traveling, and providing channels of communication between artists and institutions, and of course, with students and with the public. We're so honored that this inspirational colleague agreed to come to the National Gallery today, deliver the Wyeth Lecture on her new project, Art as an Excuse, Conceptual Strategies, 1968 to 1983. Please welcome Kelly Jones.
Thank you so much for that. A really great introduction means I don't even recognize myself with who they're talking about. But I thank you so much, and I thank you all for coming today. I'm sorry that I'm slightly under the weather, but we'll get through it. And in my manner, the way I was trained by the wonderful Robert Ferris Thompson at Yale University, you must always dedicate your lecture to someone, and I am dedicating it to my wonderful colleagues in this audience tonight, the ones I do not know, but three in particular I do, Jacqueline Francis, Stephen Nelson, and Gwendolyn Du Bois Shaw, who continue to do this work alongside, and I appreciate your presence and your work as well. So, Art as an Excuse, Conceptual Strategies is the book coming out one of these days. No, I will be finishing it. I am finishing it this spring. Basically, it's about global conceptual art networks, art and community, something that I've been invested in and thought about for my last two books, and also about art and the making of global communities. The book has chapters on art and text, installation and performance. It focuses on artists of the Americas' engagement with conceptual frameworks in international locales. Some of the artists, and this is kind of the short list, but there's always more people floating around, Asco, Philippe Ehrenberg, Loris Grobet, David Hammonds, David Lamelas, Los Grupos of Mexico, Senga Ninguri, Adrian Piper, Carolee Schneeman, Hervé Telemac, and Cecilia Vicuña. In this book, one theoretical lens I'm using to frame such engagement is that of systems theory. Systems or cybernetic theory asserted itself in the Western art world of the 1960s. It was championed by the writings of Jack Burnham and made popular with the rise of conceptual art. It reflected the focus on practices of interaction or performance that all but replaced objects as art, the rise of information-based techniques, and post-Fordist dynamics of labor. Systems theory was also seen in the dynamics of interrelation as part of a living ecosystem composed through the interdependence of human beings worldwide. In some ways, we are seeing the revival of this particular aspect with the focus of many artists on the ecological. In 1971, how we begin to braid in Latin American artists in this, there was an exhibition in Buenos Aires, Arte de Sistemas, based on the information show of 1970 at MoMA, which included David Lamelas and Adrian Piper. Jorge Glusberg was the curator, an art critic and founder of the Center for Art and Communication in 1968, where the show takes place. And he went on to develop an idea of systems art and practices, art as processes rather than objects, that led audience through experience. And he was also in residence at NYU in the late 70s, where he co-produced a book called The Art of Performance in 1979 and led to the founding of the performance studies major or area at NYU at that time. So we can see Latin American artists being really tied up with the founding of performance studies in this country. One of the writers who's written quite a bit on Argentine art, and particularly on Lamelas, but she's written on a lot of Argentine art, Inés Katzenstein, talks about somebody like Lamelas as not an exile, not an immigrant, but cosmopolitan and international, I'm going to push on that a little bit in this book, because one part of what is creating these global communities is also a response to censorship and repression. The coup d'etat in Argentina in 1966, the massacre at Tlatelolco in Mexico City in 1968, repression of African Americans that we know in the 60s and 70s, kind of COINTELPRO and the kind of infiltration of Black activist groups. Of course, we can see that going all the way back to 19th century Black codes. And then, as I bring in Latinx artists into this, as I mentioned, Asco, the kind of sublimation of Latinx people and the decolonial response. And I'll talk a little bit about that coming up. So this part of this lecture is actually drawn from part of the chapters on performance. Embedded in the move from the performativity of installations to the location of performance is a shift from modernism's objet trouvé to the situation trouvé of postmodernism. It marks a change of focus from the material to the temporal. Most importantly, the body in motion, or simply the body in and of itself, is seen as constituting a legitimate substance of art and is freed from needing any object or specific construct to be interpolated as such. The temporal nature of performance not only changed art's relationship to issues of materiality, but to notions of space and time. A piece could be placed anywhere and everywhere and enfolded in what Adrian Piper has referred to as the indexical present, that is, the here and now. These characteristics allowed performance to be dispersed quite effortlessly into the flow of everyday life as spectacle or political act, as Mexican critic Rita Eder has indicated. The territory of art was seen not as merely the domain of artists, but as an intellectual space that was shared by all. In this scenario, the artist, through her ongoing dialogical encounter with the world, is constantly processing and orchestrating the power of various voices and bringing them into view. The subtle and continuous movement between the passive position of object and active agency of subject, nominated by feminist theory as oscillation, and also other artists have talked about this, Fred Moten, Catherine McKittrick, Craig Wilkins in architecture have talked about this kind of subject-object braid, was a defining characteristic of performance art of the 1960s and 70s. Embedded in this unremitting slippage between the artist's clear construction of subjective meaning and her appearance as a work of art was a suspense factor born out of the slowness of action, inane repetition, etc., that became a form of provocation, leading viewers to their own self-reflective moments and from empathetic identification with the subject to analytic judgment. Through their presence, artists sought to raise difficult questions and make visible a parity, a greater identification between cultural workers, their immediate communities, and society. In the hands of Felipe Ehrenberg, performances became conditions. He viewed them not so much as self-contained events or situations, but opportunities for the performativity of others. And of course, he's very much part of Fluxus movement, and also inspired by situationism in this regard. In his mind, artists created environments for art to happen in and for art to happen to people. Conditions allowed for artists and viewers to draw on what Joseph Roach has identified as genealogies of performance, that is, expressive movements as mnemonic reserves. These gestures were remembered and imagined and constituted another aspect of collective representation. These more broadly drawn arenas of artists as participation were also spaces of pedagogy, places of developing awareness. If, as Ehrenberg once offered, figuration would remain a part of his own particular practice because of its greater potential for legibility with a larger audience, then the body in action was a cornerstone of his efforts to create art as a truly communicative medium. So in thinking about, for instance, Philippe Ehrenberg and David Lamelas, and also Grobet, Loris Grobet, who you see on the lower right there, I'm thinking about their work in Europe, not so much their work in Latin America, and primarily in England. And so their work is emblematic of numerous Latin American artists working in Europe, again, in light of the repression of dictatorship in Latin America in this period. So Ehrenberg is in Mexico, is in Britain from 1968 to 74, where he plays a large part in the British aspect of Fluxus in the early 70s, and he's based in London and then eventually in Devon. And then Lamelas from Argentina goes to London in 1966 to study at St. Martin's School and bops around there until 1976, and then he makes his way to LA, which I just love that. Several projects that span the 1970s speak to Ehrenberg's approach to conceptualism in its performative guise. In 1970, while residing in London, Ehrenberg formed the collective known as Polygonal Workshop, along with compatriot and photographer Rodolfo Alcaraz and Richard Kretschke, a conceptual artist from Austria. An extended garbage strike brought the artists together, and among the pieces that the group produced was a multi-part investigation of trash. This project lasted in various guises over 2 years, beginning in 1970 with Garbage Walk, an audio tape, on audio tape in film and photographs. Polygonal Workshop recorded the expanding piles of refuse that accumulated during the trash collector's walkout. In an ongoing action of their own, the artists marked these changing mounds, tracing their boundaries in white spray paint. At the strike's end, these lines were left as evidence and in their own way registered the past activity of protest. And you can see that going on the left. The multitude of documentation was then condensed, easily duplicated, then posted or mailed. All of these diverse materials were brought together at Siggy Krause's Frame Shop Cum Gallery in Covent Garden for an exhibition in 1971 called The Seventh Day Chicken. La Poubelle, or The Bin, of 1970 is a 20-minute film version of the enterprise produced in 16 millimeter and in color, which debuted the same year. And you can actually look for it yourself on, I think it's on YouTube. What's interesting about this to me is also how, I mean, everything about the whole thing they're doing is, of course, interesting, and I can't. Just in terms of how they make this into an art object that, or an action that kind of supports working people and such, but also how it relates to other things that Alberto Greco had begun around 1962, a work called Vivo Dito, where he would identify certain things to be looked at, pointing out in the words of the title of the work, different things to be looked at as art. And of course, it's, you know, we can think of Duchamp and designation, but here we have this update in a performance in the 60s in Argentina, and also in, he's also, I believe, in Paris. And here, the signaling of three objects, David Lamelas, who of course knows him, updates this in Hyde Park, London, and you can see the different ways that he's designating here, which is obviously before Ehrenberg and the Polygonal Workshop. But what's another interesting thing in terms of the garbage that I have just started investigating was part of the Young Lords garbage offensive in East Harlem in 69. So this actually predates Ehrenberg's particular interest, bringing those two together, both the kind of signaling idea and the drawing around it, but the emphasis on trash. Here, the Young Lords, who start out in 1968 in Chicago, and then pretty rapidly form a branch in Harlem, in East Harlem, in El Barrio, by 69, are protesting the fact, same thing in a way, but that garbage is not picked up in a timely manner in this Latinx community. And so what they do is they roll the garbage into the street and start burning it. And so the kind of relationship with that, which I'm still working on, is really fascinating. And it takes me to another theoretical trajectory that comes into play in this book, which is the idea of decoloniality, as put forth by the Argentine critic, Walter Mignolo, the idea of delinking, people delinking from the colonial matrix of power. And so it's also in doing work on Latinx artists and from this period, Hiram Marastane is the kind of official photographer of the Young Lords, but you can barely find images by him on anywhere. And his book, his one book, is out of print. So this is certainly an area for those of you who are looking for projects. Please. A 1973 solo show at Mexico City's Galleria Jose Maria Velasco titled Chicles, Chocolates y Cacahuates, Gum, Chocolate, and Peanuts, was an overview of recent ideas in which Ehrenberg encouraged viewers to recite poetry, try out recipes and conceptual equations, and take part in the making of a cumulative sculptural piece. And this is just an image from the catalog, which shows some of the recipes and things that he was working on. And obviously you can see, you know, the kind of fluxus kind of genre here. The image, the card on the right says, for instance, for a stony beach, separate the small stones into white ones and black ones, right? So just typical kind of actions on cards that you would see in terms of fluxus. And you see this here, of course, in Spanish. And also the fact that the top card is called Temporal Manipulations. So you see he's really working in this. And it's just fascinating to me that, you know, he's a real one of the real drivers of fluxus in Britain. Another way that Ehrenberg approached art as condition was through direct engagement with the audience in the guise of public interlocutor. At a conference on Mexican art called the Tribune of Culture, held in December 1979 at Chapultepec Park, after he returned to Mexico, he offered a lecture demonstration titled The Story of Painting According to Me, in which he set out to relate his annotated version of the history of art from ancient times to that moment. Ehrenberg's ambition for his lecture was twofold. He tried to demystify the creative process by offering a narrative on the making of objects, telling people in effect how it was done. However, he also sought to position cultural production as another form of labor and thus link the work of artists to the realities of all working people. Art was simply another occupation or form of toil, and Ehrenberg was intent on comparing the artist's role to that of the electrician or the university professor or to the doctor or to the plumber, in short, to any and all human activities which serve and have a place in society. The Story of Painting According to Me had an alternate title, Strings, Fourth Variation, which in fact more fully described the action that took place that day. In documentation, cords flow from the artist's upper body, but primarily from his hands and wrists into the assembled listeners, and behind him to a large metal frame from which hang the words, El arte es solo una excusa, art is just an excuse. As Ehrenberg elaborated in a 1983 interview, quote, art can provide an excuse to meet people and initiate friendships or to be used as a means to establish lines of communication within a community or between communities, but it can also be an excuse for ideological manipulation, the cultural arm of repressive political regimes, and a political ping-pong ball, end quote. Ehrenberg thus visualizes in concrete terms the linkages between artists and the rest of the world, how attached they are to society and to humanity in a larger sense. And so you can just see this is kind of various images from that performance. In the US, Adrian Piper too explored the epic edges of daily life with a focus on heterogeneity and difference. As Cobin Immerser has written, in the hands of this Black woman artist philosopher are conventional dichotomies of subject-object, self, other, doing, being done to, are all unsettled from the rigor of conceptual duality. I would argue that both Ehrenberg and Piper are thinking about art as a method to create a global ecosystem. I want to think about, in addition to systems theory, decolonial theory, I also want to engage the work of, and I will further soon, Sylvia Winter on the role of the human in modernity, and think about how all these things come together in these works. In an essay from 1972 titled Performing Objects I Have Been, Adrian Piper outlines a variety of disparate events in her life that have shaped her approach to the art of performance. Some of these milestones seem to have a more curious and tenuous link to the genre, keeping a journal from age 11, going to a psychiatrist, practicing yoga, studying philosophy. Others provide a more understandable connection, a stint as an adolescent fashion model, working as a discotheque dancer, dressing in costume and promenading with an assorted band of transvestites. At the age of 24, Piper is both able to identify her subjectivity as an artist and a woman and to comprehend her place as an object in certain schemas of the larger world. Her performances begin with her investigation of these two poles of existence, viewing the body as active subject and as a passive object. One of her first performances mining these polarities, untitled Performance for Max's Kansas City, spring 1970, that you see on the screen, took place at this famous watering hole of New York's art crowd. Here, Piper presented her figure as a hapless contraption in need of direction, requiring protection and care and guidance. What she discovered, however, was that her roving presence became a hostile act, constituting a passive-aggressive threat to the order of things. Quote, I learned that complete absorption was impossible because my voluntary object-like passivity implied aggressive activity and choice, an independent presence confronting the art-conscious environment with its autonomy. My objecthood became my subjecthood, end quote. And as Cobin Immerser writes, the artist's performances enacted a discrepant embodiment, undermining the binary of personhood, thinghood. At the same time, end quote, at the same time, Piper is using conceptual strategies to test connections between art audiences and the world. It was her desire to explore the shifting nature of people's understanding of bodies in action that led Adrian Piper to perform Catalysis between 1970 and 72. In these performances, the artist turned herself into an abject apparition, walking around, riding the subway at rush hour, going shopping or to a museum with gooey, smelly clothing, with gum on her face or terry cloth towels stuffed in her mouth, using public facilities which usually require quiet, such as a library, while carrying a concealed tape recording of loud belching, holding monologues with herself in public. Here, art became a catalytic agent, something that promoted change in another entity, the viewer, without undergoing any permanent change itself. Piper was interested in people's reactions to the situation, or what she called the uninterpreted as art presence, a circumstance unmediated by a museum or theatrical setting. And I think, again, leaning on Mercer, he talks about these works as kind of the breakdown of optical rules of mutual recognition, right? And it's the way he's framing this idea is that the option of not seeing, in other words, people who choose to ignore, what's going on. Like, these people on the bus in the upper right there are exercising, in some ways, the optical politics of social privilege, so that the work is actually about that kind of these ideas of privilege and seeing and viewing and the gaze. Piper herself found that in doing this, that she could break down that kind of dichotomy and found that people could overcome the disgust, anger, fear of difference, and make connections with others. The Catalysis projects led her to further examine the ways in which difference was integrated into society structures. Rather than approaching variation as aberration from an unspecified norm, the mythic being performances from 73 to 76 considered alternate reality, conscious identity, and lived experience. The artist's understanding of the potential fluidity of subject-object positions changed as she began to focus more on the divide between self, other, and later, how such questions implicate race. From the exploration of the other inside of the self, the mythic being shifted to become a symbol of alienation and anger, a figure of public consciousness who was the incarnation of the myriad aspects of pain and disaffection shared by the multitude. His further estrangement was coded by race. As Coco Fusco has written, his image, quote, dramatized through masquerade how social forces projected racial meaning onto bodies, end quote. Indeed, the phenomenology of racial identity and the pathology of racism would surface as themes in the artist's later work. Through multimedia installations and performances, Piper challenged viewers to probe their own social attitudes. As she stated, racism was not, quote, an abstract, distant problem that affects all those poor, unfortunate other people out there. It begins between you and me right here and now, end quote. As Mercer writes, in that zero-degree moment at the birth of conceptual art, then, in which the contemporary began to emerge from the demise of the authorial subject, the autonomous artwork and the disinterested beholder at the heart of the modern, the liberatory possibilities for art making amounted to a kind of conceptualist sublime, with new beginning experienced simultaneously as entropic endings, end quote. So we see, the way I interpret it, is the move from this kind of disinterested beholder that we always use when we write about art. And even in this case, if we think about it as makers making art for a disinterested beholder, to seeing art as a motor for engaged communities. Katzenstein sees a certain zeitgeist, a topicality in the art of the time that manifests itself in the insignificant, the everyday, or the banal, the hyperrealism of the banal that has the potential to spark ontological experience. And so I'm thinking about, you know, this in relationship. Katzenstein is talking about lamellas, but I would really say that that's actually also what somebody like Adrian Piper and others are up to as well, and particularly with Catalysis by Piper, and then Lamellis' film and photo work from the early 70s that he does primarily in Europe. This was transferring primacy to the viewer, with the artist's role pared down to that of a recipient of real-world data, thereby imparting to others an active role as co-authors of the artwork. And so in Argentina, if we look at the Argentine context of the 60s, the art of mass media was very significant, and also very significant in the development of conceptualism. It's also very significant in the development of what comes right before that, the kind of pop art of Argentina. Art was a kind of transmission. There was an interest in transmission, circulation, and reception, and things like the teletype, through the phone, through recordings. Lamellis, we see this manifest in his work in something like Situation of Time from 67, using televisions and not for their objecthood per se, but in terms of presenting processes and information And this piece was in the show that I mentioned, the top, Arte de Sistemas, in 1971. And we can also see it in something like La Menesnuda, which an environmental piece by Marta Menuhin and Ruben Santantonin. And it was just reconstructed at the New Museum earlier this summer, which was lovely. Lamelles was part of the team that constructed this. So basically, it's like a labyrinth where you go through all these different experiential things, kind of like an early escape room type of thing, if you know about that. Because there's some parts of it, you get in there, you're like, ah, no, gotta get out of here. So in the work from 1969, done again in Europe, a study of relationships between inner and outer space, the absence of narration pointed to the object's conditions of visibility. And so it's using film as a way to document, to gather information from the interior of the Camden Art Center to its exterior. And that's the image on the upper left. Emptying of narrative as a signaling of an artwork's contextual framework, presenting random film stills as photos, and so dismantling veracity. And he's interested, again, in the spatial dimension of time and the temporal dimension of space. In time as activity, which is going from 1969 to the present, which is on the upper right, he's using film and done in Dusseldorf originally, photo text, but film is central, where he takes 3 to 4 minute sections. There's no sound, but nevertheless, it's a document of activity in the city using a stationary camera. We don't see an event, but time. And Lamelles himself says, quote, "I wasn't interested in exploring film as medium, but rather in the concept of time in contemporary society." So film for Lamelles is a language routine. It's about the inconsequential, the homogeneous. And he's really interested in the social interactions and also the web of social networks as social systems. On the bottom is Antwerp, Brussels, People in Time of 69, where he starts to photograph his friends, critics, artists, gallerists, wandering through the city, now documenting relationships and experience of the personal, cosmopolitanism and mingling with the other, but it still remains banal. And in this way, I want to bring in somebody like Paul Gilroy, who talks about the mundanity of the cosmopolitical, as he calls it, in his book Postcolonial Melancholia, or Kwame Anthony Appiah's book on cosmopolitanism. So I think these artists are really engaging this idea of this kind of banal thing that goes unremarked in some ways, but is a way to interact and connect with the multitude. And he slowly goes to documenting his own friends. This is London Friends from 1973, showing Linda Mars. And documenting is kind of the wrong word. I'm still trying to come up with the word, so if you have it, let me know. The bond of friendship Lamelles shared with others. In London Friends, the real is colonized by fiction. Lamelles hired fashion photographer Neil Lorimer to take pictures of his acquaintances, including friends, lovers, and gallerists, and even one of himself. He once again documented his essential social context, presenting a record of his milieu. And so there's a tension between subtlety and verisimilitude, documentary and fiction, and he's really using media image cliches. And it's with this work, London Friends, that his critique of the media becomes more visible. In 1974, he does rock star appropriation, and using the idea of the star as a photographic signifier, making the character as a pure function of the framing light and distance, camera angle. There's close framing, no contextual info. It's shot from a low point, and so it's like the spectator becomes a supplicant. And these are all things that Katzenstein has talked about. It simulates the persona's banality and the live concert's exaggerated ecstatic gestures. The work has been compared to that of Cindy Sherman over and over again in literature on La Meleth. But of course, you know, Cindy Sherman also talks about how she's indebted to who? Adrian Piper for some of those early works. But I'm also interested in Chicano artists who are doing the same thing with no movies, right? Where they create this Chicano cinema, which is fake, right? They don't have any film because they don't have any money for film, but they create the stills and pretend like they've actually made a film. And so this is what they're doing in LA between 73 and 76. Just so happens that David Lamelas touches down there in 74 and becomes makes it his home by 76. And this is another work that he's done with the same type of idea called The Violent Tapes of 75, where he exhibited a series of imagined film stills from a non-existent film that interrogated the cinematic language of spy and action films. So again, the same practice that has really been overlooked when people just go right to Cindy Sherman. I love Cindy Sherman too, but I'm also interested in Asco and how that works in the context of LA, in the context of Hollywood, right? Which is fascinating. And part of how we can see all these people together in LA, of course they're in LA, an important aspect of this is the Long Beach Museum of Art. From 74 to 78, they had a post-production studio, and a lot of that archive can be found at Getty Research Institute. And this is where David Lamelas starts making these films in LA. But also, who else is there? Some of my other favorite folks, these guys, who also have a show in about 1977 at the Long Beach Museum of Art, including Sengen and Goody. Some of Sengen and Goody's early forays into performance were done in the company of other artists who formed the core of Studio Z, a loose collective of African-American artists based in Los Angeles. Members of the group had been making art for at least a decade. They came together in the 70s as a cohort of practitioners bonded not only by generation, but also by interests and a certain focus with materials, mixed media, process, performance as the glue. This work flouted the framework of designated Black activist content by which the era would come to be known. Instead, the radical aspect was in the materials, was in the profile of art by African Americans that somehow did not read as African American art. It utilized fragments of everyday environments whose origins provided only an echo of familiar content. As Linda Goodbryant and Marcy S. Phillips noted, these artists used remains, elements left over from a primary action. Indeterminate character also drove the action, which was of a performative and participatory nature, uncharacterizable in that it seemed outside of traditional representational roles. The work of Studio Z both vexed and freed Black representational practice. The group came together at David Hammond's studio on Slauson Avenue, sometimes weekly, to engage in spontaneous actions. These were performed in the streets of Los Angeles as well. Studio Z had a changing membership, including at various times Frank Parker, Houston Conwell, Maren Hassinger, Ulysses Jenkins, and Rojo, along with Hammonds and Ngudi. Hammonds's space, a huge old dance hall with a wooden floor, was a perfect space to work out ideas, and you see it there on the left. And of course, I've written extensively about this piece, Ceremony for Freeway Foots of 1978, with Ngudi there in the front and Hammonds here and her frequent collaborator, of course, Maren Hassinger. But the piece that I am focusing on in this book is something that hasn't been written on. And I finally started interviewing her specifically about this piece called Get Up, which was performed on December 1st, 1980 at the Paper Mill in Los Angeles and sponsored by the Los Angeles Printmaking Society. And I've actually, so you see the kind of invite or the program here, Maren Hassinger, who is performing along with Yolanda Vidado, and we'll see her in a minute. Ningudi is really the choreographer. I showed something that was perhaps a part of this drum in Now Dig This. I think it's now in the National Museum of African American History and Culture, if I'm not mistaken, that Senga Ningudi, after Now Dig This, gave it to the museum. So it's here in Washington, which is fantastic. And the way this comes about is Houston Cronwell is part of this printmaking group connected with the paper mill. And so Ningudi's idea is she asks to make a living sculpture, right? She provides the materials, and this sculpture is kind of built on these bodies. And Frank Parker and Khan will execute that aspect. And then a ladder, let's see if the ladder is back there, I think it is important in terms of thinking about the higher plane in this work. And Get Up, for her, is about putting on clothes, right? It's not about the higher plane, as I thought it would be, no. It's about somebody has a get up on. So it's also about self-fashioning, but it's very fascinating to me because it's linking to some of the younger artists that I see working in her kind of mode. Somebody like Eric and Mac, who was just in the Whitney Biennial and had a show at the Brooklyn Museum in terms of the engagement with fashion. And I always thought that Ningudi was not engaged with fashion, but in fact, she references it. And for her, this performance and others were about sketching, playing all around town, doing this and that. I have this idea, let's try it over here. She described it as a drawing session, except with bodies. And the idea of providing bodies for others' ideas so they can flesh them out. And so another aspect of this, which I'll go through briefly, is Senga Ningudi in Japan, which I have written about somewhat, but every time I've interviewed her over these many years, she kind of doesn't give me any information about it. I go this way, I go that way. And so I'm just going to study Japan on my own. But she was based in Tokyo between 66 and 67 at Waseda University. And so what I'm starting to do is map artists who were engaged with Fluxus, Mieko Shiomi, Ayo, Saito Takako, maybe even Yoko Ono, I don't know. I know she was involved with Fluxus, but just mapping these networks that I've been fascinating with and how they overlap. Because sometimes artists just don't give you much, even though they're alive and you're trying to get there. But also, you know, the relationship with somebody, you know, we think of 6 degrees of separation. Somebody like, or the Bojas Prest, which is basically started in Devon by one of the co-editors is Felipe Ehrenberg, and they have different issues, and also another magazine that is produced by them called Schmuck, and you have various Japanese artists participating in that in Japan. And of course, another thing that Senga Ningudi just alludes to very, you know, obliquely is that Alan Kaprow's book, Assemblage, Environments, and Happenings of 1966, is also a motor for her to go to Japan, which has a good representation of Gutai. So that is all further to be worked out this spring when I go back to the Getty. So I'm really interested in the circulation of these ideas throughout the Americas in books, media, such as photo, film, and video, mail art, and the structures of mass media, as well as social networks and bodies. Which brings us to Lourdes Grobet of Mexico. By 1970, Lourdes Grobet had turned decisively to photography. Going forward, she would experiment with the medium in ways that pushed at the edges of its analytical and physical constructs. Una Hora y Media, Hour and a Half, of 75, one of Grobet's first solo performances, is perhaps better described as a photographic happening. The performance took place at the Casa del Lago, a non-commercial gallery affiliated with the National Autonomous University of Mexico, or UNAM. The performance was designed as a lecture demonstration, and she outfitted the gallery with trappings of a dark room, including equipment for developing and printing images and safe lights. And so we can see this kind of link to pedagogy that Ehrenberg, her compatriot from Mexico, is also interested in. During the hour and a half period, she described and illustrated the step-by-step methods of bringing a photographic image into being, working on three large images of herself. The condition was completed when Grobet hung the photographs on the wall, then switched on a large quartz lamp, which momentarily illuminated, then immediately dissolved the images. Purposefully, the artist had not chemically fixed the works, causing them to disappear in regular light. With this performance, Grobet both created and destroyed using light, reenacting in her own way the burning alluded to in the photographic process. In vandalizing some of her own images and those which no less depicted her own body, she hoped to also decimate the myth of photographs as serious and permanent documents and reveal their vulnerability as containers of veracity and history. Una Hora y Media also interrogated how one might fix an image, that is, hold on to ephemeral sensations and impressions and appeal to memory. Here, Grobet begins to push the social parameters of making over technique. After a less than enthusiastic and indeed angry reception to Una Hora y Media, Grobet left for England, and she studied at Cardiff College of Art and also Derby College. She studied photography and design. There, between 1975 and 77, her experimentations revolved around creating conceptual objects and conditions that would catch the public's eye. To this end, much of what she did was fun. She invented situations of amusement and pleasure that she hoped would still communicate the complexity of changing notions of photography. And we can also see this, how British Fluxus is also part of her world as well. Perhaps with the 1975 performance in mind, she endeavored to create a space that more clearly advanced a dialogical relationship with the audience. As someone who had voluntarily uprooted herself from familiar terrain like Lamelas, the artist became interested in the connotations of the traveling show. How would the meaning of objects be changed by a new context? Could the idea of motion be engaged as a concrete entity, and to what effect? In dialogue with this concept, she organized her own traveling exhibition in 1976 at Derby College of Art and Technology. It consisted of a series of photographs installed in an elevator. In this scenario, Grobet created a situation where changing audiences and shifting locales were dictated by a combination of chance and certainty and constant flux. In 1976, Britain also held a year-long series of festivals and counter-festivals commemorating the 25th anniversary of Queen Elizabeth II's reign of the English monarchy. Grobet joined in these activities by presenting her own homage to the Silver Jubilee. She photographed a variety of everyday objects in collision with each other, printed them up in black and white at sizes of 8 by 10 inches or smaller, then affixed them to her body and moved through and outside of the gallery to which she was an invited participant. Called Jubileo de Plata, the piece was a literal translation of the English phrase, which took on an entirely different meaning in Spanish. As used by the artist, this title signified a sort of silver frolic or romp indicated by the wildly careening objects, Grobet's body in motion, and the silver and the chemicals which brought the images into being. She performed the related walking exhibition in 1977, the following year. So I also want to think about how these images relate to something else that's happening right at this time in Argentina, right? The Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires, right? And these grandmothers began their protests. They organized in 76, and they began their protests also in 77, where they walk in the Plaza de Mayo, very important plaza in Buenos Aires, which is dedicated to, you know, the founding of Argentina, getting away from the Spanish, and so on. And every Thursday, I think at 3:30, they march to talk about their grandchildren and children who were disappeared in the dirty war. The artists don't really talk about it. And I think part of, you know, artists, you know, lead you astray many times, which is fine. That's why you have an archive. That's why you have your mind to kind of make it up. Like, yeah, really? You didn't do this that way? No? No? Okay, sure. But I think it's also part of this idea of connection to the human, the kind of collaboration and conviviality, where you don't have to be demonstrably political in certain ways, but that action of recognition is part of that. So there you have it. And interestingly, you know, Grobet is not an Argentine, right? Lamelas is, but he doesn't do anything remotely as political in some ways as this, although he does do one piece at the Venice Biennale and then drops it. As Carlos Monsiváis has suggested, the body insinuates that which is difficult to name. Speaking of Cantinflas, whose lapses of verbal intelligibility accompanied by lucid and often lewd physical antics made him one of the most popular comedians of 20th century Mexico, Monsiváis writes, quote, "His body gestures organize the chaos of his words. Cantinflismo is the double language of that which seeks to be expressed and that which does not feel like being thought," end quote. Such circumstances where repression may be in the specter of censorship, the active exclusion from official social institutions of representation, or the form of physical brutality makes for art that increasingly relies on an array of double-voiced, allegorical, and parodic strategies. For these cultural practices and their producers, there is a twinning of audience, of meaning, of understanding. What looks avant-garde may be a fragment of lived experience. That which presents itself as just art has an agenda of underground signification. And why is it that Adrian Piper has also a piece called It's Just Art, in which she does a performance, and it's also multimedia, looking at violence in Cambodia and war. What is clear from these examples in performance is that though the human subject may have been buried or deconstructed, it never vanished altogether. The body did not disappear from the work of these artists because the subject could not. For in life, these were people whose existence was challenged daily by the exigencies of political and racial violence. In art, they were constantly disappeared from the Western canon and the historical record. The greater difficulty was, in fact, holding on to selfhood and subjectivity. For these same reasons, the body and the body politic had to continually reassert itself in works by these artists, either by way of the image, the performative, or through the participation of the population at large. Using the body as image, material, or as palpable presence, they ensured their connection to subjectivity and to life. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.